Okay, I'm an addict named Frank.
Hi, Frank.
Hey, everybody. Feel very, very, very lucky to be here today. Kind of feel like it's going to be a rough one. I feel a little emotional, no doubt about it. This is a topic that's very, very personal to me. I obviously have some experience with it, or hopefully I wouldn't be up here in front of you folks. You know, it's funny how nervous we get doing this, even if we've done it a few times. And for me in particular, it's pretty silly that I get up here and get nervous, because I have a fair bit of experience with this topic. And really, all I need to do is get up here and tell you guys my story, you know, and hopefully you guys will get a little something out of that. And I'll tell you really quick, just to give you some background about who I am as an addict. I'll just take about 2 minutes to cover that, you know. Very much like I think the vast majority of you folks that are in this room, I think I just kind of lost my way at some point in my life, you know. It seemed like fun for a little while, but very rapidly it deteriorated, and I watched my whole life fall apart around me. I became exactly who we read about in the readings. You know, I became unemployable, derelict, didn't have a place to live, unreliable. You know, I lived to use, I used to live. And I think the worst part of the whole thing was it got to a point where I not only couldn't look anybody else in the eye, I couldn't look myself in the eye anymore. That's a very, very sad state of affairs to be in. You know, I was miserable. I was introduced to recovery a couple of times pretty early on in my life through H&I. As a teenager, as a matter of fact, it didn't really stick, you know, and I still ended up going back out and experimenting some more and acting out and practicing in my addiction, and I did finally reach out for some help in my very early 20s, and I did manage to actually stay clean for a couple of years, but you know what? I was still the same addict, because although I did stay clean, I still was a thief, still was a liar, still was a womanizer. I tried to get over in life just about any way that I possibly could. I practiced, I was still gambling, you know, left and right. Basically, all the things associated with the negative aspects of my character that were directly associated with my disease, except for the fact that I wasn't using, were still a part of my life. Had a sponsor simply in name, didn't really use them, didn't really work the steps. Just kind of showed up for meetings and did the social aspect of this thing, and it worked for a little while, but pretty quickly it stopped working. And they ended up going right back out. And just like our literature talked about, when I went back out, I ended up exactly where I was that last few days when I was out there the previous time. And I just, man, it was like my life just fell off a cliff. The little bit of things that I'd managed to put together as far as being employable and getting some responsibility back in my life in that couple years' time just evaporated almost instantly. My life just fell apart completely. And I relapsed really, really hard. And I stayed out there for a few years. And you know, the biggest thing that kept me out there, you know, was my arrogance. You know, I just wasn't willing to admit I couldn't do it on my own. I wasn't willing to admit I was wrong. I wasn't willing to come back in here and sincerely ask for help. You know, it was pretty rough relapse. And about halfway through that relapse, I found out something about myself that was going to change the course of the whole rest of my life. I found out that I was HIV positive. You know, this is a pretty long time ago. You know, I found out that I was HIV positive in 1990. At that particular time, I mean, HIV was pretty much a death sentence. You know, there's not much more that could really be said about it at that point. There was no medication, no viable treatment for it. Very little hope existed for people living with HIV. Life expectancy was about 3 to 5 years back then, you know. And I found myself in a place where I felt more alone and more afraid than I ever could have possibly imagined. And unfortunately, I just continued to stay out there. That happened about halfway through that relapse, and I continued to stay out for a little over a year after that, and I just watched myself spiral downward and watched my world get so small and so dark, and I just really, really had very serious thoughts of killing myself. I just didn't know what to do anymore. And thank God for me, I did finally reach out for a little bit of help at the local county health department back in Montgomery County where I live. And that's actually where I tested positive. And they actually deferred me to and suggested that I go to where? A Narcotics Anonymous meeting that just happened to be meeting right there at the county health department. And it was a meeting called Positively Addicts, you know? You figure it out, you know? And thank God for that meeting, because that meeting no doubt saved my life. I was so afraid of how people were going to treat me, what people were going to say when they found out about this. I mean, this was a time frame when people were just starting to really accept the fact that this thing was only communicable through, you know, sexual intercourse with, or at least contact with sexual bodily fluids and through blood and that sort of thing. I mean, just prior to that, in the late 80s, very few people were educated about, you know, how HIV was even being transmitted. People were scared to death. And I was scared to death of being judged, of being ridiculed, of being labeled, of being shunned. I didn't know how people were going to treat me, you know, and thank God for this meeting, you know, and I spent a couple months actually in and out of there, popping by on a weekly basis. Some weeks I would go, some weeks I wouldn't. I kept going back out, you know, throughout that time frame, and then something happened, you know, something happened ultimately a couple months into that, in March of 92, I guess I just finally reached an emotional and spiritual bottom with this whole thing. I finally had had enough, at least up until today. And I sincerely started asking for some help within myself, outside of myself. And really, actually, the first place I went to was to my family. I finally told my parents about my situation. And they were devastated, you know, and it was hard because I had to sit there and deal with the guilt associated with that too. I mean, they were destroyed. You know, they thought I was going to die as well. They took it really, really hard, and that was rough on me, but you know what? Thank God my parents were there, you know. That was a big, big deal, no doubt about it, because I needed all the help I could possibly get. I didn't know which end was up anymore. And they were there for me, and I'm very grateful for that. You know, the next place I went to for help was finally, sincerely here, wholeheartedly in Narcotics Anonymous. And I went to a meeting. It was on a Tuesday night. It was a meeting that isn't around anymore. It was called Stepping Out of Trouble. And I picked up a white chip, you know, March 24th, 1992, and I haven't found it necessary to use since. Thank you. And I had to really step out on some faith a little bit at a time, you know, and it was all about trusting people, you know, the one thing I wasn't very good at. And I had to come in here, and it took me about a month before I finally told one person, you know, outside of the few folks I was running into at that Positively Addicts meeting, and told him the truth about what was going on with me. And it was okay. And he gave me a hug, and he told me he loved me. And I built on that, and I managed to tell a few people about it. And I know it's hard to believe, but word got out all of a sudden. Woo! Imagine that. And you know what? I took that as a blessing, because what I did is I felt kind of awkward at first, and I felt kind of afraid at first, but you know what? I went to my home group, which is a meeting called The Outsiders, and a couple days later, you know, I went to my home group, and I shared about it openly in front of all my home group members. And you know what? You guys didn't do what I expected you to do. You didn't run for the exits. All of you guys stood up and gave me a hug and encouraged me, told me it was going to be okay. And I can't tell you guys how much that meant to me and how much strength I drew from that. And for the first time in my life, I mean, I really started feeling a part of, I started feeling safe, I started trusting in some people, and started working on all that stuff. When I was right about exactly a year clean, it was a week after I had celebrated my first anniversary, I actually was involved with somebody when I was using, and they had gotten involved in another fellowship, and I hadn't seen him in a while. We actually split up a while before I got clean, The craziest thing happened. I actually went to this other fellowship, which I almost never went to, and a friend of mine was celebrating there, and I sat down, and lo and behold, who did I sit right behind, unknowingly, was this, you know, this woman that I dated for a couple of years, and we were both out there using. And she, as it turned out, ended up getting clean just a couple of weeks after me. And we both were just about a year clean. This had to be God's will. Had to be. And in spite of my situation with the HIV, she decided to give it a try. And we were together for about 6 months. And I had so much insecurity, you know, concerning the opposite sex and everything that entailed all that, because I can tell you guys that back in the early 90s, there was not a whole lot of women lining up to date somebody with HIV. You know, not a whole lot. And I kind of threw all my eggs in this basket emotionally. And you know, it fell apart. And it was pretty rough the way it fell apart. You know, I'm really, really grateful for it today because she was honest with me. But she was very blunt with me. You know, after we were together for about 6 months, things started going bad. And I'll never forget the last night, you know, we were together and she was very blunt. What she told me was that she just couldn't deal with it, you know, that she was afraid that I was going to get sick, afraid that I was going to die, and afraid that she was going to get infected along the way. And that was rough, you know, that was rough. Certainly I had these circumstances going on with this other disease, but I mean, I had never been heartbroken and clean to begin with. I mean, I was destroyed. I was absolutely destroyed. And I will never forget, I would go into meetings and I would just crumble. I would just sob uncontrollably. And people hugged me and they took me to dinner and they just hung out with me. And my phone rang off the hook and people were looking out for me left and right. You know, the typical stuff that goes on around here once we build some relationships in here. And things did work out. And I made it through that, you know. And that was a really, really big deal for me, you know. It took a long time. I mean, I remember just waves of pain I had never, ever experienced before, as far as that kind of heartache, you know. Just silly stuff, too. I mean, craziness, like, you know, I'd be riding down the road listening to the radio, and those damn people writing those songs, they were writing them all about me. So, you know. I mean, I'm telling you, first couple months after we had split up, I couldn't even listen to the radio hardly. It was like torture, you know, because it just kicked up and stirred up all these feelings. But I did make it through that stuff and started to learn some things about myself. And I think, you know, for me personally, I didn't even date for like almost 3 years after all that happened to me. And that was one of the biggest blessings I got from all that pain, was detaching myself from those kind of relationships, because it's really easy for this addict to lose himself, you know, in a relationship with the opposite sex, and especially when I was that new around here. And I spent the next few years, partially out of sheer fear, sheer terror probably is the best way to put it, and partially out of self-respect, really working awfully, awfully hard on myself. And I really devoted a lot of time and energy to service, to working the steps, to working with a sponsor, to hanging out with friends after meetings and building those friendship relationships that hopefully last a lifetime and are really, really, truly meaningful. I was introduced to service certainly here in Narcotics Anonymous and was taught how valuable that can be, and I got a whole lot out of that. And I kind of got to carry that over into other aspects of my life. And I actually got really, really involved in service in the HIV and AIDS community. That was a huge, huge blessing. I can't even begin to tell you guys, you know, the people that I got to meet as a result of that, how powerful they were as far as examples of how to live life, how to you know, take on challenges and move through them. And it turned into a situation where it became a huge, huge part of my life. And I ultimately was doing all kinds of stuff. I became a speaker, an HIV and AIDS educator with a few different organizations. I got involved with grassroots lobby efforts, and we'd go down on Capitol Hill and talk to Congress people and senators on a regular basis every spring to try to get appropriations and money out there for people who couldn't get the money and the help for themselves, for housing and medications and things like that. And I don't throw out all those things because I'm trying to toot my own horn. I'm throwing out all those things because these are some of the things that I got to do with my life because I came here. And you guys showed me how to make a difference, you know. And God, I got so much out of that. And God, the people I got to meet through all that, you know? And when I first got started doing all that stuff, I remember how it all got started was actually, I was just over a year clean, really. The first time I got up in front of a bunch of folks and started speaking publicly about my HIV situation, and my God, did I break out into a cold sweat. Actually, pretty similar to what goes on when we get up here in front of you guys. So, not all that different, but I would have to say a little more intense. And some people were in my life that really just kind of grabbed me by the hand or maybe just gave me a kick in the butt and got me going because they saw something in me that I couldn't have possibly ever seen in myself. You know, that I had the ability to give something. I had not a clue that I could do something like that with my life. And I did. You know, like I said, I mean, it's been a big part of my life for a lot of years, and I've gotten to do a lot of neat things, and I've been propped up and told all these positive things about myself over the years, about how courageous I am and how proud people are of me and this, that, and the other. And truth of the matter is, you know, I'm just so humbled by the people that were here before me concerning all that stuff, because I had to watch a lot of those people die, unfortunately, the vast majority of them. And the truth is, I'm not very courageous at all, because the people that were here before me, the people that gave me a kick in the butt in the early 90s to do that stuff, they were doing that kind of stuff when people were afraid to touch them. And I can't even imagine what it was like for them. But they stood up, and they stood up for what they believed in. They stood up for themselves and for a whole lot of other people who couldn't do it for themselves. God, those people meant so much to me. And you know, just seeing that those people had been willing to do that gave me so much hope, you know. And seeing them, you know, take on the challenges that they were presented with gave me so much hope. I watched a whole lot of people go through a lot of different things that gave me hope. And you know, I was listening to the speaker last night sharing about Bill T, and I know there's a number of people in this room that knew Bill. I certainly did, and you talk about a really powerful, powerful example of how to deal with some real struggles in life, and how to do the very best with what you got, you know. And I learned so much from Bill, and I really feel so blessed to have been able to been a part of his life, And I look at Mary, and I know that she's a very powerful example of what to do when faced with some really, really difficult circumstances, you know. And I certainly cherish, you know, all the people that I meet in my life today, you know, that teach me such valuable things like that. You know, as time went on, I had been around the rooms for a couple of years. Something happened to that meeting, Positively Addicts, actually. I don't think it lasted maybe 6 or 8 months into me being clean this time around. And what happened was the Montgomery County Health Department had to renovate. The meeting got the boot, and it just kind of fell apart. They never really found another place to meet. And after a couple of years of that almost, somebody found it necessary to get another meeting going that maybe would help some people out. A meeting called Illness and Recovery started in the Montgomery area. Started off really, really small and really slow. But a number of the people that were going to the Positively Addicts meeting, you know, got wind of it, and they started showing up again. And you know, it wasn't a special interest meeting in particular. It was just a place that hopefully these people could go to and get some help and be together and help one another. And it was a really, really tight, small group of people. You know, one of the people that frequented the meeting regularly, as well as myself, was another gentleman named Frank C. And it's funny because a lot of people called me Big Frank, and they called him Little Frank. And he also was a person living with HIV, and he had an AIDS diagnosis. And he was pretty sick. You know, things were pretty bad with him. His immune system was pretty darn torn down at that point in time. A little while into this group forming and us getting together, he started to get very sick. He ended up with some lesions on his brain, and he deteriorated really, really rapidly. It didn't take long at all before before Frank lost his sight. And it didn't take very long after that before Frank ended up in a wheelchair. And it was to the point within a couple of months where Frank really had a very difficult time even being taken to meetings, and he was pretty much having home hospice done. And you know, there was one or two folks in this illness and recovery group that made certain that Frank had meetings going to him on a really regular basis, you know, a few times a week. And it was really, really powerful. I mean, it was a situation that had one of the most profound and powerful impacts on me throughout my entire life, because people would come out in droves, you know. Oftentimes we couldn't even fit us all in, like, kitchen dining room area, and there's a couple of people I'm looking at right here that were at some of those meetings. And Frank, you know, Frank just went downhill really fast, you know. And we did manage to keep meetings going in there for, I don't know, I guess maybe about 5 or 6 weeks altogether. And, you know, I have something written that I keep in my basic text, and I just jotted it down on this little piece of paper because I've read this at a couple meetings, and it just really stands out in my mind. And before I even read this, I want to say, I mean, I am not a religious person, and this, some people might take, you know, this little poem I'm going to read to you guys with some religious context, and believe me, that's not my intention. But it was just such a powerful thing to sit in that dining room and look up and see, when I saw the amount of love that was there for Frank. And it was actually something that was stitched by his mother, who was already gone at that point, and it was in a little frame, and it said, "Let your strong love for each other prove to the world that you are my disciples." And I just remember, you know, always looking up at that, and I wrote it down, you know, on a little piece of paper, and to this day I have it in my basic text. And you know, things got really, really rough with Frank, and you know, Frank ended up dying, like I said, you know, maybe like 5 or 6 weeks after he was pretty much homebound. And the one thing I can say is that Frank died, you know, with a candle by his bed, and his bed was completely surrounded with addicts. They loved him, you know. And about a week before that happened, we had taken a meeting in there, and it was kind of touch and go that last couple of weeks. And there were nights where we would come in, and he just really wasn't even well enough to sit up with us and get the meeting. And but he was, and this one time, it was probably might have been the last time that we actually had a meeting there in that kitchen. And we were leaving, and he had lost his ability to talk. And I was leaving, and I remember we all just kind of would, you know, lean down on, you know, at his wheelchair and give him a hug. And I went to give him a hug, and I started to get up, and he kind of grabbed my hand, and he pulled my hand up to his face, and he kissed my hand and held it against his cheek. And he couldn't tell me thank you, but he could do it that way. And boy, oh boy, I will never forget that. It was just a really powerful moment. And the bottom line is, you know, he was just so grateful not to be alone, you know. He didn't have a lot of family around him, you know. And his dad, you know, which is where he was, kind of took care of him when the hospice nurse wasn't there. But he really just had us, and we showed up, you know. We showed up 100%. And I'm just so glad that I was able to be a small part of that. You know, I tell you the other thing, you know, when it came time for Frank's funeral, Frank's family, you know, because Frank was a very low-key guy. He just always kind of was quiet, never had a whole lot to say, very shy. And his family, I think, was just so blown away when we had that funeral. And I mean, there must have been 100 addicts in that funeral home, easy. And they just couldn't make heads or tails of it, you know. But the bottom line was, he was just really, really loved and respected, and he dealt with the challenges he was dealt, you know, to the best of his ability. You know, for me, I can tell you that, you know, I've been through a lot of different things concerning, you know, living with HIV and illness and recovery, and you know, through all that stuff that I just shared, you know, with with him going through that, and I watched a lot of other folks get sick. I watched a lot of other folks die. A couple of other folks in that meeting ended up passing away in the next couple of years. It was really rough as far as HIV and AIDS was concerned, in particular in the mid-90s. And up until that point, up until around 95 or so, my health had been really relatively good. I mean, yes, I had this disease called HIV, but, you know, my T cells, which is whatever, just a way that they measured, you know, engaged how healthy you were still pretty healthy, and I was doing my thing. I was working full time. And then in 95, all of a sudden, you know, the bottom just started to fall out of my immune system. And because my health was pretty good for that first few years, I was in denial. It was so easy to show up for work and show up to meetings and go to dances and go to conventions and live my life and not feel really, really sick, you know. But all of a sudden, all that started to change. And in a very short period of time, you know, my immune system just collapsed pretty much, you know. My T cells went down to the low double digits, which is really low, believe me. You know, statistically, I mean, I was at risk for almost anything to happen to me. You know, anything could have killed me at that point. You know, most likely pneumonia. I was just devastated. And I had a clinical, you know, AIDS diagnosis just before Christmas in 1995. And man, I will never forget. I went to a meeting. It was called the Nuclear Blast. And I had gotten my AIDS diagnosis that night. And I went to that meeting, and I not only identified myself as being Frank and being an addict, I identified myself as being Frank and being a person living with AIDS. And that was so hard to say, you know, so hard to say, because, man, it was right here all of a sudden. It wasn't off on the horizon anymore. And you know, the next 3 or 4 years of my life were pretty rough. I didn't respond to medications. A lot of medications really weren't even available at that point in time. They were just starting to put some drugs out on the market that were ultimately going to end up being pretty effective as far as dealing with HIV. And I was getting on one clinical trial after another. And I kept failing. I kept failing all these medications. I mean, none of them would work out. And this went on for over 3 years. I mean, I was just kind of, I was almost running out of hope. I was still trying to hang on to it as best as I could, but things didn't look good, you know. My doctors didn't have any answers for me, you know. And we'd pretty much run out of options. And I can tell you that I went through a really difficult time as far as tolerating all these drugs. I mean, they did a lot of damage to my physical well-being as it was. I mean, back then a lot of people were over-medicated, it just wasn't very pleasant going through all that stuff. A lot of weight fluctuation, a lot of problems with gastrointestinal problems, you know, whatever. I don't have to get graphic, but I mean, you know, headaches, diarrhea, the whole nine yards. I mean, I just didn't feel well. I felt horrible, you know, all the time. And after a few years of this, my goodness, I mean, I kind of threw my hands up in the air and I told my doctor, I'm stopping. I'm going to stop my medications. You know, a lot of people told me it probably wasn't the right thing to do. A lot of people told me maybe it was the right thing to do. And looking back on it, you know, maybe it saved my life, because maybe it gave me an opportunity to allow my body to finally heal up a little bit, you know. And that was in 1998. And really, considering the circumstances of what was going on with me, my mental state was, I felt like everything I did in 1998 was the last time I was ever going to do it. You know, it was really weird, and I'm from overseas, I'm from Southern Europe, and I made plans and followed through and actually went home, and it was really surreal, you know, sitting there in the town where I was born, you know, in Southern Europe, really believing deep down inside, although I hadn't lost all hope, that I was probably, you know, never going to be there again, of all places, and probably didn't have a whole lot of time left on this earth, period. It was just a really, really weird year, no doubt about it. But in the late fall of 98, a new drug came to market, or at least was available on clinical trial, I should say, and we got some old drugs together. Finally, my doctor told me to try a new medication regimen, and after being off meds at that point for about 4 or 5 months, I kind of felt up to it, and I gave it a shot. And we finally got some positive results. And they weren't much, but finally I got some positive results. And really, it took some time, but over the next probably 3 or 4 years, my immune system started to build itself up to a reasonable level. And things just flat out started to work, you know, as far as all that was concerned. And I really turned the corner, you know, with my health, finally. I can tell you, I was so, so grateful, because there was a lot of other things really that I was really down about. I mean, I was so sick. I mean, I was on disability. I wasn't able to work. I was a man in his early 30s who was dependent on his family for food, for shelter, for my, you know, basically my livelihood, for anything that I needed. And it was just rough emotionally, you know. I think I'm a fairly humble person, but to humble myself on that level was really hard. You know, it wasn't easy at all. So there was a lot of stuff associated with all this besides the physical aspect of my disease, you know. And dealt with a lot of depression, no doubt about that as well. And to finally really see some hope and see some light at the end of the tunnel and to see some improvement in my life was such a relief. And thank God that things turned out the way they did. And ultimately, you know, over the next few years, I started to really get my life back together. You know, I started to go back to work. I started a small business. It ain't much, mostly just me, kind of a handyman service business. That's kept me going for a while now. That was a big deal. I can tell you, another thing that I wrapped up right around that time frame was college. You know, throughout all that, I actually kept going to school, plugging away, and got a college degree. And, you know, we come in here, and one of the biggest things that we're taught when we're struggling with something is to just act as if.
That's right.
You know? And I remember in the midst of all that, when I was really, really sick, I mean, a couple of the things that I did that really reinforced that within myself was, you know, going to school. And another thing I did, it might sound kind of silly, but I went and got braces. You know, my teeth were all crooked. I didn't feel good about it. And I just wasn't convinced at that point that I was going to be gone, you know? So I said, okay, I'll go through the trouble of this. And I went and got braces. But, I mean, that's a big part of life, you know? I mean, we struggle with a lot of different things as far as addiction is concerned and trying to figure out how to live life on life's terms. You know, maybe we don't really have a good connection with a higher power. And all these things that we struggle with, you know, here as addicts. And we're told to just act as if. And that was a big part, you know, a big part of what kept me going, you know, kept me mentally square, kept me right in my own head, you know. If I just acted as if things were going to be okay, maybe they were, you know. I mean, a lot of different things come into play as far as that's concerned, too, and that's certainly something that looking back on my life, you know, as far as, you know, dealing with a disease like this, dealing with illness and recovery, you know, I mean, a lot of things come into play. I mean, as far as, do you have access to good health care? Do you eat well? Do you have other stuff going on that's going to put a lot of stress in your life? You know, are you surrounded with good, positive, loving influences and people? Do you have help, you know, as far as dealing with stuff emotionally in your life, which is certainly a big part of what we're about? But I think the biggest thing, and it kind of ties into what I shared about a second ago, is just attitude. Do you have a good attitude? You know, do you have something to live for? I mean, as scary as it is, I went to a lot of support groups, you know, that were specific to HIV and AIDS, and it is the scariest thing. I watched people walk into those rooms, believe they were going to die, and they died.
Come on.
I'm telling you guys, you want to shake some life into them. You know, you want to do something to tell them it's going to be okay. But if they're hopeless, there's nothing you can do, you know? And that's so vital. I mean, that's one of the biggest things I learned through all this, you know? You know, besides the little business that I put together, and I did go to college and finish that, I ultimately became a homeowner, you know? That's been a really big deal. I never thought that would have happened for me in my life. And the bottom line is, you know, I've put the pieces of my life back together, you know, in spite of all this. And And I'm just so grateful for that. You know, I have to say that, you know, being clean and living through the things that I've lived through and the experiences that I've had, you know, it's been over 16 years now. And I mean, what have I learned through all that? I mean, I have to say that first and foremost, I have to look at where I've been and all the things that I've been through, and most of all the people I watch die, and I have to wonder, why am I even here? I ask myself that all the time. And the truth is, I don't know, and it doesn't matter, but I damn sure better make good on it. You know, that much I do know. And I do the very best I can concerning all that, you know. I mean, once again, I mean, you guys taught me so much about service and how much we get out of that and how much we can help other people. And I really, really do take that to heart. And I do the best I can on a daily basis to make good and to show up and try to help some other folks. You know, in so many ways, this has been a two-edged sword for me. I wouldn't have wished, you know, all the negative things I went through concerning this disease on anybody, okay? But this has been the catalyst to so much positive change in my life. I would have never dreamed I would be the human being that I am today. Not in a million years, you know? And it's just what I ended up having to go through to get to where I'm at today. I'm very grateful for HIV. I wouldn't be half the man I am today if it wasn't for it. That much I know, 100% for sure. You know, in general, I mean, some of the things that I've learned that maybe I can throw out at you guys, you know, concerning, you know, illness in general, is to empower yourself. I've learned that doctors don't know everything. You know, empower yourself with knowledge, you know. Allow yourself an opportunity to make good, healthy decisions for yourself. You know, get other opinions. There's a lot of information out there, you know, and one person in particular doesn't know everything, you know, and really, really take that to heart. If anybody out there is struggling with something, I would 100%, you know, throw that at you. Really, really seek out as much information as you can and make good decisions about your health and listen to your body. Listen to what it's telling you, you know. Sometimes my body was screaming for mercy, you know, and I can be real pig-headed, and sometimes, you know, I just kind of kept trying to fight through that. And I can be real hard on myself, and I have to take a step back and listen to my body and love myself a little more in some circumstances, you know, concerning illness, that's for sure. You know, I can tell you the other thing I've learned, and there's a few other things, is that I can't, but we can. And that's something you hear in recovery all the time. And I've managed to accomplish a lot of different things in my life. I've been traveling to a lot of places. I've achieved a bunch of things. I didn't do any of it alone. Not one bit of it, you know. You guys were there every step of the way. You know, I was a scared little boy when I came in here. And that didn't change overnight, you know. The vast majority of the struggles I went through, especially that first 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years of recovery, you guys helped me so, so much. You know, and gave me so much courage to do the things that were necessary to improve my life. I could tell you something that I really try to live by too through all this is, you know what? Don't take things so seriously. Have as much fun as you can every single day of your life without hurting yourself or anybody else. And baby, there's some people in here who know me, and I live by that creed. You know, I got a twisted sense of humor. I love to have fun. And I show up. I mean, I don't care what it is usually. I mean, I'm up for it. You know, we just don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And I try to stay in today with all that stuff, you know. Dreams do come true here in NA. No doubt about it. I've had a whole lot of dreams come true for me. And that's been such a blessing that I got to come here and have all that materialize, you know. And the last thing I'll say is don't pick up, you know, and that's something generic that you hear in the rooms all the time. But as far as this particular topic is concerned, for what it's worth, I mean, I really believe that I'm a miracle and that I shouldn't be here, you know, and outside of, I should say above the phrase don't pick up, don't give up, no matter what, you know, just don't give up. Thanks for letting me share. Talk.
No coincidence. to thank Frank for giving his experience, strength, and hope. And our next speaker, it is truly an honor and a privilege. For our next speaker, can we give a warm welcome for Mary?
Hi.
Hi,
my name's Mary, I'm an addict.
Hi, Mary.
Pauline, you know. Frank? I don't know how to follow that. I really don't. First of all, I gotta say, I didn't know who was gonna be the other speaker with me today. Then when I found out it was Frank, I thought, well, I know him, but I don't know what he's ill with. You know, I never knew. Anyway, there was so much that you said on a feeling level that is my story and that I can relate with. Okay, I better get started because I'm getting like aphasic right now, so because I'm nervous. And you know, I've been having this problem where like I cry when I get hypersensitive. So if I start crying, you know, don't think, this is a time where we need to cry, because I'll cry ordering a pizza, okay? So now that I've said that, hopefully I can get through without falling apart. So I just need to relax a little bit, because what I've learned is that when I'm asked to speak, I don't have to be nervous, because I'm not going to get up here and tell someone else's story. All I'm going to do is share with you my experience, strength, and hope, and tell the truth. And most of the time, I learn, as well as you guys learn about me, I learn about me too, because I ask for guidance. I ask a power greater than me to speak through me, to help me, as well as somebody else in the room. And so far, every time I get up and speak, that's worked. It's worked well. And also, I ask to be somewhat entertaining. And that works too. You know, at least when I put that out there, you know, it helps me relax. And that's one thing that I really need to look at is relaxing more. Not getting so stressed out about every little thing, because the big piece about illness is, you know, whether it be cancer, whether it be a cold, whether it be heart trouble, diabetes, whatever, it's all a result of stress. And I've only just recently learned this. And the way we live, every day, every moment, what we do is going to affect our health in one way or another, and this all ties into recovery. Okay, so let me back up to how I got here. I got here because I used drugs. You know, like all of us sitting in a room. Hopefully, like all of us are sitting here because one, we want help to not use again, but two, we want to live. And in 1988, I think, or 89, not sure, I was 16, no, it must have been 87. A friend of mine's mother took me to my first meeting. I dropped out of high school, I was smoking crack, and I didn't care about anything. Brought me to a meeting. I don't remember where it was. I know it was in Laurel. I don't remember the meeting. I don't remember the night. But I remember people were there, and they were getting these key tags, and they were smiling, and people were clapping. And I want to know how I got one of those, how to get one of those key tags. And at the end of the meeting, I got one. I got a white one. And it felt good. I didn't stay clean, but I kept going to a meeting now and then, and then I wanted an orange key tag, and I could never get one, and people would say to me, you know, and I would use, and they would say to me, Mary, keep coming back, you know, you need to go to rehab. Then they started saying, you need to go to rehab, and I didn't understand. I thought I was going to rehab when I was going to a meeting. So, you know, there was a lot of confusion and a lot of using, and I was hitting bottom steadily, drinking, and I went to my family, and I asked them for help, and they didn't know how to deal with drug addiction or what it is. Actually, my mom took my house key, and she said, you know, go talk to your friends about that. You know, and so anyway, bottom line is what ended up happening is I ended up overdosing and going away to a real rehab and growing up in the I got introduced to the program through a juvenile facility when I was 17 years old, and that was a good thing for me because I went back to high school because I wanted to get out of the juvie home for 6 hours a day. That was the only reason why I went back to high school. Okay, so this lends itself to intellect, to manipulation, to my addiction, you know, to all the things that make me who I am today. And back then, I was an addict. I've always been an addict all my life. I just didn't know it. I didn't know everything about who I was, who I am, whatever. I still don't know today, and I think that's a gift, because I don't want to get sidetracked, because I really didn't plan at all. I know it's hard to believe, but I don't have a script. I didn't write an outline. I didn't rehearse. Damn it. So anyway, I'm at this juvie home, and I'm thinking, I'm gonna graduate. And I'm telling people, I'm telling my sponsor comes to pick me up to go for a GED, and I said, the day she came to pick me up, I said, no, I wanna walk across that stage. Why? You never said that before? Mary, you're almost 18, so I don't care. So anyway, I did. I walked across the stage. I had about a year and a half clean. I was supposed to be on probation for a long time. I mean, I kept getting arrested. I don't even know what all my charges were, but I know they could have actually kept me there until I was 21. And they didn't, you know, and I felt really good about that. So I graduated from high school, was going to meetings, had a home group, had a sponsor, and would go out and play cards every Friday night with everybody and date, and I was 18, and then I drank that summer, got a DWI, and came back to the fellowship, and I would put together some clean time, go to meetings. Every time I was clean, I really loved the fellowship. I would go to meetings, and a lot of drama, and I date a lot, and I was young, and I always thought, you know, this is good for today, and I could do it for a day, and I was still doing it for the key tags, you know, and the anniversaries, and I got like 2 years once, and I was like, wow, this is great, and then I pick up again, you know, over dumb stuff. It didn't take much for me to say, oh, okay, you know, fuck it, I'm gonna use, I try not to cuss. That's important to me. You know, I hang out with people now that they're really good role models in recovery. And they teach me things like recovery isn't just about staying clean, it's about how we live. Wow, that sounds cool. Okay. I've been so blessed this time. I'm gonna skip a whole lot of the drug log because it's really, what ended up happening is I would put together a couple of years and then I would go back out. And I think the last time, the only reason why I wanted to stop was because I was running out of money, and I'm a big drinker. And I was worried that if I didn't graduate from college and get this job, that I wouldn't be able to drink. and there was a lot of fear. And so I was like, I can't go back to NA because I disrespected them. Because I turned 21 and I decided to go ahead and buy some beer and get high and do coke and I couldn't go back because these people had helped me so much. So what I did, and this is all my addiction talking because this doesn't even make sense, okay? But I'm telling myself these things and I'm believing them, that I needed to go to AA, take antabuse, get on antidepressants, and go to school. And I could live in this household with these crazy people, which I happen to be related to, but they were drinking and partying and riding motorcycles, and I didn't do any of that, so I felt like I was winning a little bit. And I ended up graduating and got my nursing license, but I never felt like a nurse. I never felt like any of these things really, they didn't mean anything deeply to me. And then I went back to Laurel, and I went back to that old sponsor from NA, and I asked her to sponsor me again, and I told her I was gonna be serious about it, and I was gonna go to NA meetings, and I'm just gonna stop the abuse. And, you know, so I was being as honest as I could be at the time, but I was never completely honest. That was the whole thing. So I would write steps, and I would talk about God, talk about the first, second, third step. I got 2 years again, and I have an associate's degree now, passed my nursing boards. I have my first apartment, a couple credit cards. And I'm thinking, man, that program is fantastic for people who need it. Thank God all I was a troubled teenager, right? And if I come across people in this job that I'm working at, which happened to be for the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, that I would definitely refer them to the program. I would never associate myself with it. But it was a good place for people to go and learn about themselves and to stay clean. I've seen it work. And then I meet this man who tells me all the right things, and I had known him before when I was 16, when I was in trouble, and he had grown up and I had grown up. And he told me I wasn't that bad, and I really didn't need to go to meetings, and if all I did was drink, I would be okay. And you know, I was just, it didn't have to do with him, it didn't have to do with anything, it had to do with the fact that I had not fully accepted who I was, or that I could not. I was just messed up. And I made a decision to drink again. And I don't think I've ever said this in a meeting, but I'm gonna say it today, because why not? When I drank, I felt relief that day. Because I thought, well, I can just be who I am now and not have to worry. And everything's gonna be okay as long as I have this guy in my life and keep my job. And you know what happened? It was exhausting. It was exhausting 8 next years of my life to convince myself that I didn't have a problem and to show everybody else that I didn't have a problem. And it involved a lot of moving. First one was to move to the other side of Laurel away from my sponsor and network. And then that wasn't far enough. I had to find a house way out in Carroll County. And that even wasn't far enough. And then it involved just a lot of like house. I had to clean the house so that I could drink on the weekends and never drink on work nights. And then when I started breaking that rule, it was like never ever will I do drugs again. And then I got my jaw broken at work and found painkillers. And I was like, well, they work so much better when you combine them with alcohol. And now I know what people in the meetings were talking about. Well, that started a daily habit of opiates for the next 5 years. But I didn't know it because it wasn't crack, because I wasn't running around in the streets. I wasn't robbing and stealing and lying like I used to when I was a teenager. And in fact, I had gotten so bad that I didn't even remember that part of my life. Like people would ask me, you know, well, I don't know. It was like it never happened. I never went to juvie home. I never came to a meeting. I was able to remove, just disassociate, and this is scary to me, but I could disassociate as if my life started when I was 24, when I got married. It was like that was when my life started. And then the sad part was 6 years later, when the age of 30, when they threw me a surprise party, and I didn't think anybody cared about me anymore. And I was fat, I was like 175 and out of shape, and my knee was in a brace because I had a multiple, I would get messed up every day. And I got home to my house and they had this huge surprise party, only I didn't enjoy it at all. Because on the way home, I was feeling really bad about myself and bad about the situation of turning 30 on a Saturday and not having any friends in my life. But I stopped and got an eight ball and did some and got to the house, and then I was so embarrassed. But I of course finished the drugs. You know, but always when it ran out, and then I was like, you know, what next? You know, I had the house, I had things. I wasn't smoking crack, but we were spray painting the windows in the basement, but we were saying we were so much better off, you know. As my husband and I, he became my biggest friend, using buddy, and then we would argue and we'd fight, and it got ugly sometimes, got very, very physical, mostly on his part, because I would get aggressive, and then it would just turn ugly, and in the end, somebody suggested that I come back to meetings, and I said no. I said, I know I have to leave rec, and I have to quit doing the hard drugs. but I really was at the point where I thought that I would never, ever be able to stop taking Percocet or Vicodin, or, you know, because it had messed up my brain so much that I couldn't live without them. Anyway, definitely knew that I was going to lose the house, and I hadn't worked in maybe, I don't know, 6 months. I hadn't been at my job because I went ahead, we bought four-wheelers, and just stopped doing as much coke and partying on the weekend. And then what happened is that, of course, we combined the activities. And and I ended up having a really bad accident. And when I got clean, people knew me. I was wearing a knee brace. I was doing knee surgeries. And the last knee surgery I had, and I need to share this, I was only on the narcotic meds for 2 days. And man, did I not like that person who I chose to dole out the meds. But I love her today. So that, jumping up to 2002, I was miserable, wanted to die. I had a black eye and glass in my back, and as my husband and I got in one of our fights, and this one was different because the kids were present. Like, he had a daughter. I never had any kids, but I had a niece and a nephew that were living in my home. And I just felt, you know, I gotta get out of here because I gotta show them. Even if I run away and die, I gotta show them that it's not acceptable to live like this. And I attribute any of that to anything I may have learned or picked up in the rooms for those years that I spent clean, because I always believed that it didn't matter that I didn't stay clean. When I was clean, I at least learned something different, and that it did stay with me, but the important parts I must have missed. So this time, I got out of leave. I quit my job. I retired from it. I've been there 9 years. I was vested, so. And you know what? They tried to test me, and I had a friend call me. Like she was like, "You really want to go in there?" And she's like, "Are you sure?" I said, yeah, I'll be fine. And I was fine. And I, grace again. I was $40,000 in debt. Sold a house. The real estate market was up. Credit card debt all went away. Had a little bit of money left over. So this is how my God has blessed me. But then I'm down in Southern Maryland at this woman's house who was the last known person that she was still talking to me, and she knew me from when I was 16, and she knew me when I was clean, she knew me when I was using. She was really all I had left. I had called my mom and asked her if I could come back home. Just to live there for briefly, because I was leaving Rick. And she said, "Why are you leaving Rick?" I said, "Because, you know, he hits me sometimes." "Well, Mary, you need to keep your mouth shut." So, anyway, that wasn't an option. She didn't want me there. Do I have 5 minutes left?
No.
Oh, okay. 2002. I show up in Southern Maryland, Iraq, and not really sure what to make of my life. I sold my house. The worst part about all that was getting rid of my dogs. I love my dogs, and I let one go to a neighbor, and the other one went to the pound. And I had my mom agreed to take my bird Cosmo, which was really cool. I had this one parrot that I had like 15 years, as the longest relationship I ever had in my life, and I wasn't about to, you know, give that up. I don't know what I would have done. She accepted him, so that was cool. And I'm down in Southern Maryland, and my friend says, "Mary, I insist you go to a meeting." She says, "As soon as we get through this last knee surgery, and you know, I'll take you." I said, "I don't know where any are." She said, "We'll find one. We'll go online and we'll find a meeting." And we did. And I did. I went. And at that meeting, I remembered the key tags, and I remembered the feelings, and I cried. And it felt like I was home. And I met this fantastic woman. Okay, so I'm there. And they pass around a little phone book, and everybody puts their numbers in, right? And it's as if, I don't know, I just felt a little bit of hope. And when I would leave that meeting, it was a Tuesday night meeting in La Plata, somebody followed me out to the parking lot. And it freaked me out a little bit. And I said, I was under specific instructions only to talk to the women, and only the women with 5 years or more. So she's out at the truck, and she's like, "Hey, you know, what's your name? Blah, 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 blah." And I'm like, "I just got to go. I have to leave." And and I said, "How long do you have clean?" She said, "5 years." I said, "Oh, no." She said, "Where do you live?" I said, "Well, you know, here." And I pointed, and I had all my stuff in my truck, right? And then I left. But this went on, you know, for several times when I'd go to meetings around. Yeah, I was going to a meeting like every night, and she would follow me every night. So finally, you know, my friend says, "You know, it's been 30 days, Mary. You're going to call and get a sponsor," you know, because she knew a little bit about how the program works, probably more than I ever knew. And I'm so grateful to her. So I call her and I say, "Well, you know, what are you doing?" She says, nothing, you know, my husband's out of town, blah, blah, blah. So we have like a nothing conversation. So I call again, and we have a few more of those. But see, this is my process. Eventually I ask her, you know, are you sponsoring anybody? And then I ask her to sponsor me. And she says yes. And then I used again. And it was like, it was so weird because I was going to meetings every day. I met her and her husband, and I was building a little bit of a foundation, you know, talking to her every day. And we were talking steps, and we were talking about how I didn't believe in God, and about how I felt that was like one of my biggest problems was I could never really stay clean because I could never get the second and third step. I didn't understand that you didn't have to identify a God in those steps, but she didn't. She was like, well, let's just get to know each other, blah, blah, blah. She spent hours listening to me, and I would call every day, and I'd tell her about my crazy family. And about just about anything. And then, you know, I accidentally fell into a service position on a convention committee because she invited me over for a little meeting over. And so I ended up joining up. And I said, I don't think I can commit to a year. And she's like, you know, yeah, you are. The day I used was very simple, that I woke up in the morning and I knew what I was about. I prayed and I read the Just for Today. And I was praying, I didn't know why. I had said, does it count if you don't know who you're praying to? And they said, certainly, just do it anyway. What the hell's wrong? Would you pray, don't pick up and go to a meeting. Don't complicate this. Okay. So I go out and the guy in my house, he's getting high on coke, and he offers me some, and I said no. So I'm just gonna sit here and drink coffee. He offers me again, I said no. He says, Mom will never know. I said, all right. And it was just that quick, and I got so mad, and I knew what to do because I'd gone to meetings every day. It was Sunday, I didn't go to a meeting on Sundays, that was my day off. I went out back and I called Jeannie up and I said, oh, sorry. I called her up and I said, I told her what I had done. And I told her how mad I was. And then I said, does it count? And she said, yeah. And then she told me exactly what to do about it. And I said, I'm afraid. I said, you don't know this woman. If she comes home and I tell her what I had done and that I did it in her house, she's gonna be so disappointed. And she's gonna kick me out, and I don't know where I'll go because I don't have anywhere else to go. And I was so mad at myself, I wanted to die. I always wanted to die. I always had that left out. That was like my ace in the hole. Ever since I was a little girl, if things didn't go right, if things didn't feel right, I could always kill myself, right? And I would fantasize about it. I even had like death songs, right? Like I knew what I wanted playing, and everybody would feel sorry for me, but it would be over, and I wouldn't have to have the stress of life anymore. So this time, I was playing it out, how I would kill myself when I told her, and she got so mad, and she called me names, and she wouldn't talk to me, and she was pissed off at me. And this is actual what happened when I told her that I had used, and I told her who I used with, and she was so pissed off at the both of us. And she was blown. She didn't even know. She didn't even know it was ever in her house. It was the one substance that I told her I couldn't be around. The next day, I went over with those people, and I went, and I surrendered. And I surrendered that night, actually. I picked up the text, and I read through it, and I kept coming across that word surrender, and that's what I needed to do. I needed to quit fighting, quit trying to figure this shit out, and just follow direction. And that's where it started, and that's where I felt a spiritual feeling. For the first time, I felt something inside me change, and that feeling was a gift, and it's still there. Every single day, I can get in touch with that feeling just by thinking back to that moment and that night in that bed and how good it felt to know that I didn't have to use again ever. And then it was so simple. All I had to do was reach out, and I already had somebody in my life. So there must have been a power greater than myself, you know. And then months went by, and I kept doing service. In fact, the very next day I went and I got a home group. And then I wanted to work steps. I wanted to honestly work step. I wanted to read them, and I wanted to answer the questions with honesty and not sound good. I didn't care about sounding good anymore. I cared about staying clean, and I listened to all those tapes of Bill T. that Dave lent me, and that man has such a powerful message, and I would encourage anybody, if you've never heard him speak, please listen to some of his CDs or tapes. He saved me back then, and he's still saving me today. I feel a very strong connection to this man, even though I never met him. And then I changed sponsors, and I didn't do that right. I didn't do it gracefully, and thank God it didn't destroy the relationship. I had two sponsors for a long time, but only one knew about it. I was working steps with one and not so much with the other, and I was giving the other a hard time about not working steps. And anyway, I don't want to say everything because the long story is that everything happened for a reason. And I'm here today to stand before you and to speak, and it's an honor. I don't believe that I'm all that special. I believe this program is very special, and that it's a gift, and that it's available freely to anybody who wants it. If you really want this thing, then you might have a chance at it. And if you get it, even for a moment, don't play around with it, please. I see people play, and that bothers me. That's on me. I want to go back to where I was, where I need to be, where got a job again, and it just happened. Things are just happening. They're just happening because I read in a text about changing everything, and so I focused on that, and my sponsors were telling me, all you got to do is show up, Mary. You don't worry about changing, because that's going to happen. You bring the body, and the mind will follow. So I'm listening, and that was my second step, is to start listening to direction, and I need to remember this today, because today I have issues again with the second step. I have issues throughout my life. Life in recovery, life outside, life in recovery. Recovery is my life. And it didn't promise. I mean, you hear people, they come in and they say that you'll get this, you'll get that, you'll get that. Well, I started getting those things, and it felt really good. I started getting the car, and I get to networking and friends and the good job and the money and saving money and looking to buy a house again. And I couldn't decide where I wanted to live because I'd met so many wonderful people in recovery, and I was living in Golden Beach for a long time, which wasn't a bad place to get clean, but there came a time around 9 months where I felt like my recovery was in jeopardy, and even if it wasn't, it didn't feel real good to go to meetings and live this life of recovery and then to go home where people, they just didn't understand. They were drinking, they were partying, and they loved me, and I knew they loved me. And we would talk meetings as they passed around a joint. And it just didn't feel right anymore. And then one day I called my sponsor and I said, I'm thinking about moving. And within minutes, I mean, not within minutes, but probably an hour, and that's no exaggeration, people were at my doorstep with trash bags, packing me up and moving me out of that house, up into Waldorf, into a woman's house who I believe today was an angel for me, because it was the first time I lived with anybody in recovery, and she had over a decade clean, and very wise, she had a lot of integrity, and she lived this program, and I was living there, and it was going to be temporary. I ended up staying there a year. I was working in oncology. I had gotten a job in nursing that didn't conflict with meetings. That was real important to me, and it turned out to be a dream job. I was still going to, I was going to meetings every night. I was working every day, working in, and I was doing convention service work. And and it felt good. My life was going real good, and I was dating. There was some drama in there, and I was working some steps, you know, but basically the bottom line was every single day I got up, I hit my knees and was said, take my will and my life, got me in my recovery, and show me how to live today. Every day, I still say that. So, I'm getting ready to move out. I'm still building relationships with people. I'm getting scared about how to move on with the steps. I did a fourth step, did a fifth step, started sponsoring people. Feel an added responsibility now. So I start seeing a therapist because I get real scared because I look at my life and how, I look at my life and how I have these fantastic relationships and then they get destroyed and then they disappear. So I start seeing a therapist and then I'm leaving work one day and I get mugged. And I have about 2 years clean. I'm working steps. No. At the time. Okay. Now I have a little over 5 years clean. But but the day I get mugged, they find a brain tumor. And. And they tell me that that it's inoperable. I'm telling them I don't have a brain tumor. I had a lot of my life. And it can't be. And they said, oh no, we did an MRI. It's been there and it's huge and you're gonna die even with treatment. I said, well, what is that gonna involve? And I'm crying, I'm upset. And they said a craniotomy. And you know what, my friends in recovery were there and I look around the room and there's vases and there's flowers and there's cards and they only think I got mugged. Nobody even knows I have a brain tumor. I call Jody and I tell her I have terminal cancer, and we had just talked on Wednesday night after a meeting, what would you do if you got a terminal diagnosis? Because I had just found out about this cool thing called an eternity chip, and I said I would never pick up. I can't see myself picking up for any reason. And this woman, she had like 18 years with us, she said, you know what, I don't feel like busting her out. She said she would have wine and a cigar. And she said, really, really good wine. And I said, nuh-uh. But 2 days later, I'm laying in the hospital.